All right, now the 55th chapter of Isaiah, then we're going to proceed with it. Ho, everyone that thirst, come ye to the waters, and he that hath no money, come ye, buy and eat. Yea, come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Wherefore do ye spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Incline your ear, and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. Behold, I have given him for a witness to the people, a leader and a commander to the people. Behold, thou shalt call a nation that thou knowest not, and nations that knew not thee shall run unto thee because of the Lord thy God, and for the Holy One of Israel, for he hath glorified thee. Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain cometh down and the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth, and maketh it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and prosper in the thing whereto I have sent it. For you shall go out with joy, and be led forth with peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth before you into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree, and it shall be to the Lord for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. Remember, in terms of our last discussion, that we're saying basically and historically this is something that is for Israel. They have come to total destruction, bankruptcy, in terms of their national purpose. The figure of speech here is basically applied to our own situation spiritually, in that we must in ourselves really come to the place of personal failure or bankruptcy before we're ready to turn to the Lord adequately. We have to be convinced that we're not going to make it on our own. Before we are willing to give up our right to independence and commit ourselves to Christ, in the world of economics or finance, the procedure that is followed normally in business failures is that one goes into receivership before they actually go into bankruptcy. And by going into receivership, they are admitting that they have been unable to handle their financial picture themselves, and all the monies that are brought into the business go into the hands of a manager of their finances, whoever is appointed to that, and that money then goes to someone else, a third party, who distributes the money in a more equitable fashion. Receivership means you've admitted that you are not able to handle the finances, and you're letting another party straighten them out for you. Then if that doesn't work, then you go into absolute bankruptcy. When I talk about bankruptcy in terms of Israel, I'm saying that they've come to total collapse, and now God is saying to them that he is willing to take over for them, but it's going to have to be his power that is going to do this and not their own. They have demonstrated their inability to handle their lives. We mentioned the phrase quite a bit earlier, the flesh is willing, but the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And people probably, it probably is not too unusual a thing for a human being to seek after religious objectives. We do have a certain fleshly bent in this direction. There's not an ethnic group in the world that doesn't have some kind of worship, some kind of religious form, some kind of God that they worship. Ethnic group, we're referring to non-racial, but certain group, social, culture, whatever, but a tribe, for example, is an ethnic group. A nation is an ethnic group. Wherever you have people grouped together in some kind of a sociological pattern, you have an ethnic group. That is to say, of a national pattern, you have an ethnic group. Now, I'm saying that this applies to tribes, to nations, sometimes to clans, to various kinds of groupings. Universally, there is a tendency to have a religious object of worship. So it's no great thing that people are religious, but it is a great thing for them to come to the realization that they cannot satisfy God with their own religious efforts. So no matter how much you may attend a service of worship or a religious group, no matter how much of that you may do, unless there's an intrinsic change, that is, unless the Holy Spirit comes into the heart, it is a fleshly effort, and like all fleshly efforts, not very dependable, because you're up one day and down the next. You see, it's not a dependable base for life just to be religious. Well, the children of Israel found that out, and they came to complete bankruptcy. God's antidote for that bankruptcy is the coming of His Holy Spirit into their lives. And that's what the 55th chapter of Isaiah is all about. Those who now have become thirsty must come to the waters. Prior to their collapse, or prior to their realization of their failure, they would not likely come to the Lord because they would not feel that they were thirsty and did not need His help. He said, those that are thirsty, come. He that hath no money, come ye, buy and eat. Yea, buy wine and milk without money and without price. So the condition of the human flesh, the natural man, the condition is helpless, and he does not have anything within himself to bring to God. Therefore, the glory is all of God. If you save yourself, the glory is not all of God. You have too much dependence upon what you have done. And I imagine there'll be quite a few people who go to heaven, stand before the Lord with the feeling that at least you have to admit that I did this or that. You see. At least you'll have to admit that I memorized faithfully or... that I did my lessons or did my personal work. You'll have to admit that I exercised more willpower than the rest of those clods down there. There'll be people that'll feel that way, you know. I just have the sense that they'll step before the Lord with the waiting for Him to commend them for their special efforts over the rest of the unworthies. But they may be disappointed. I don't think that any of us, when we stand before the Lord, are going to have anything to say about our own efforts. Even if they are sturdy efforts, they are always tainted with the fleshly image, the fleshly ambition to be religious. There are people who strive for the mastery in spiritual things, not so much because they really care about Christ that much. They do care, or they wouldn't strive at all. But it isn't that they care so much more about Christ than others. It may be that they just have to be a cut above everybody else. There are people, whatever they do, they want to be the best. That's all right as long as it doesn't minister to pride. But there is a lot of that in spiritual effort. That's why we have to press this matter bankruptcy so much. Because there comes a point in our lives where we have to be so totally shattered that we realize that there's nothing for us outside of Christ, or there's no way that we can ever make it. I gave you the illustration some weeks ago, I think, about the person that falls overboard from a ship. And he may be an Olympic athlete, the champion swimmer of the world. And someone throws a life preserver out to him. And he is embarrassed to think that he has to have a life preserver. And he says, no, it's all right. I'm an Olympic swimmer. And so the person on deck has to say, but it's 1,000 miles to Liverpool. You know, no matter how much of a swimmer you are, you may be the best, but it's beyond your capacity. Now, there are a lot of people who feel they swim pretty well. I talk to many people who try to let me know that they really have got their head together pretty well. And if I start talking about the things of the Lord, they're very likely to say, well, I'll tell you one thing I always do, and that is I always try to treat other people right. You know, I may not be so great about this or that. And there's always something. The moment they start defending themselves, then I know that there's something out of order there. The soul that is going to receive the ministry from Christ is the soul that cares enough about receiving it to reach out. So we have nothing to offer him. So we come without money and without price. Wherefore do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. And there are thousands of things, diversions, in this world that Satan can get you off on. Ultimately, they are not satisfying, but he tends to know what he has to dangle in front of you to get your attention. Everyone has something different. And Satan has a little box full of goodies, and if he can't get you one way, he'll get you another. Now, for the person that's been on the road a while, he's not likely to be tempted with some rather gross thing, you see. But Satan has a lot of other things in his box, and he'll pick out what he thinks would entice you, and it often will be something that looks quite innocent on the surface, and he'll pull that out and dangle it. And if that doesn't work, he'll pull out something else and dangle it in front of you. He'll keep trying until he gets that thing that's going to appeal to you in some way that can get you hooked or get you started. Anything, no matter how good it may be on the surface, has a potential of diverting one from the things of God. If you were professionally competent to determine what was good for people and what wasn't, then it would be different, you see. You were in a position of leadership. But any time you involve anybody else in what you're doing, you better pray about it first and ask the Lord whether he wants you to do that or not. Because you don't know what rather innocent things that you are presenting to them could be a destructive force, because Satan will use it in their lives. All of that under the category, why spend you your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? I'm saying to you, the things that we do in this world that are of the flesh, everything has a potential destruction in it to the flesh, because the flesh is incompetent to really gauge what is good for it and what isn't. That's why you have to keep before the Lord. I've said to some that in a certain sense we're kind of like the CIA. If you're in a program of government secret service, nothing would be incidental. If you were out in another country as a secret service agent, you'd have to consider that every place you go and everything you do has its implications. It isn't that you shouldn't go those places. It is that you shouldn't go or shouldn't do those things without first checking out the situation to be sure that this is something that is not going to be a problem. I'm saying to you that the flesh being what it is, Satan being in control of the realm of the flesh, everything you do can have implication for your spiritual growth. And without putting a straitjacket on you, I'm saying to you that just as you parents check out the things the kids put in their mouths, or should check out the things the children put in their mouths, so you as a Christian, as a believer, ought to check out the things that come into your life and the things that you might bring into the life of somebody else. And be pretty sure that you're led of the Spirit when you get involved in things. Now, the way to do that, of course, is not that you have to sit down and have a major discussion with Christ over going to the grocery store. I don't mean that at all. If you're in fellowship with Him, there'll be a check that comes to you, and then it's a good thing just to mind those checks. That's why it is important to get with the Lord daily. If you spend a moment before you get into the actions of the day, if you spend a moment in prayer and meditation, you are more likely to be able through that day to sense the checks of the Spirit. To sense that when you're making a move, it's something that maybe you shouldn't go too hastily in, you see. So this doesn't mean you have to stop at every street corner and ask Jesus the directions. Now, I had to illuminate this point here about why do you spend money for that which is not bread and your labor for that which satisfieth not. The children of Israel in the development of their nation did many things that were quite all right for the surrounding nations. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with building a palace, for example. There might be much wrong with building a palace if it is not to the glory of God, you see. That's why I said before, there's nothing wrong with a person owning a home or buying or building a home. There might be a lot wrong with it if it is in the wrong spirit and for the wrong reason, and if you are not the kind of person that the Lord can trust with owning a home. See that? I'm trying to make a very practical application of something. It's a direct application. Israel was doing a lot of things in the flesh that were crushing out the vitality of their spirit and ultimately destroyed them, because what started out as a simple interest in building the nation ended up in idolatry and destruction. See? It started out with a very innocent idea. We want a king because we're not getting along too well without a king. Nothing wrong with having a king intrinsically, basically. But if God did not want them to have a king, then there was a lot wrong with it, and that was true, because He knew they couldn't handle it, and they couldn't. And I've been in the unfortunate position of having to be the spoil sport about a lot of things, because I see things down the road that the other person doesn't see. And to them, it is a simple, innocent thing. And how often have my ears been bombarded with the query, what's wrong with it? Or the other statement, killjoy. I'm the ace killjoy. Because there are things that I sense in the spirit that would be totally not obvious in the flesh. And I have to say on the surface, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with eating a dish of ice cream. If you're a diabetic and you eat a quart of ice cream, there's a lot wrong with it, you know. Maybe a dish of it, there's a lot wrong with it. What's one man's meat, another man's poison, I guess is what it says. No, it isn't setting a relative standard. I'm not saying that morality is up to the individual. There are some things about morality that God is specific about, but I'm talking about a lot of those things in the flesh which are not immoral of themselves. Anything that's a matter of morality, that's a different question. It's not relative. You can't just do what you please. But the things that are relatively harmless and things that are of the flesh, just understand that Satan is in charge of the whole realm. And if it's something you're doing in the flesh, it has a destructive potential in it, and you better be dead sure that it's what the Lord wants of you, or He wants of those that you're involved in it with, you see. For Israel, it was much more serious than diversions in the flesh. For Israel, it was a matter of the destruction of an entire nation. Now, God has put out to them the invitation here to come back. Don't ever let Satan tell you that you might as well forget about it because you've already blown it. Common thing that I hear, too. One feels, well, I've already made my mistakes and the Lord is finished with me and so forth. Don't let Satan tell you that. No matter where you are today, whatever your previous mistakes may have been or your tangles of life are, bring the whole mess to Christ. Don't try to straighten it out yourself. Bring it to Christ because He has a way of cutting through the Gordian knot, so to speak. God has a way of cutting through things and getting down to the reality and helping you to take your life under control again and put it back together again. As far as that which is the most important element is concerned, that is the element of the Spirit, now let me give you an analogy on that. Let us take the phenomenon of the ceramic studio, making of pottery and so forth. Someone has made a carving or made a sculpture. Now they make a plaster of Paris mold into which they are now going to put the medium to make duplicates of that original sculpture. That's the way of ceramics, or of any, a lot of objects of art are made that way. So here is the original thing. It may have been carved in wood or it may be stone or whatever, but here's the original carving. A mold is made for that carving, from that carving, and now many imitations of that or duplications of it are being made. Now let us say that here are the molds lined up. They all have the same thing inside, the same object of art. Now, one of those molds falls off the shelf. It's broken up. So hastily, because there's not much time to get this large order out, hastily another mold is put back together again, maybe the same one, but it's pretty awkward looking. It's not quite as neat and smooth as the others. So there's the complaint. Well, now wait a minute. This mold doesn't look very good at all. We can't stack that up along with the rest of it. And the answer is, well, as long as the inside is the way it's supposed to be, we won't worry about the other part. As long as it'll make the same object for us, we don't care how it looks on the outside. Maybe your mold has fallen off the shelf. A lot of things are broken up by it. And maybe the Lord has to put you back together a little bit differently than you had originally hoped or intended. But as long as the object of art inside is going to be properly handled, the rest of it doesn't matter, you see. Now that is true of every one of you. Your spirit is the thing, of course, that God is after. What He wants to shape. What He shapes with this world's situations. You can trust Him to put your life back together again in such a way that that part of it will be perhaps even enhanced. Your spirit will be molded by God in the way He puts your life back together again, even if it doesn't look the way you think it ought to. Here was Israel. They would never go back the way they were originally. They couldn't. They suffered a great loss in many respects. There was a long period and still continuing period of alienation from God. Meanwhile, though, God has put things back together again, and this time, perhaps even with enhancement, that is, it's a greater thing that He now offers them than they had before, because now He offers them a perfected object of art within, a spirit. here in this 55th of Isaiah, he is inviting them to turn again to him, forget the past. There will be scars from it, but let's leave it behind, and let us now go on to assume that each day of your life is going to be a part of God's eternal process in the development of your spirit. You may start from this minute, no matter what you've had in the past, what desolations have been wrought in your life. You can start from this minute and be as whole spiritually as anyone in the room. And the other part doesn't matter that much. I wouldn't say that it doesn't matter at all. There may be ways in which your external life suffers a scar that it would have been nicer if it didn't have to be that way. People get married and they marry the wrong person and divorce comes into the picture and things get torn up. It's hard to put them back together again the way they were. And it's impossible, in fact, to totally restore everything as it had been. And I would not stand here and say it's better that that should happen at all. I would say it would have been nice had they married the right person in the first place. Would have saved an awful lot of heartache and agony. Life might be a little more orderly and smooth and so forth for them. But it is a secondary consideration, since God did not come into the world to make us contented. He came to build our spirits. And almost everyone must realize a scarring. The very nature of the human flesh being what it is, the very tendency to make faulty decisions with regularity, that very tendency means that every believer on earth at one time or another suffers from faulty decisions, from mistakes. One is not better than another. Some mistakes are more obvious than others, but everybody has within their lives a multitude of scars that say to us, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, and keep us from depending on the flesh. That's the main thing. We don't depend on the flesh. We don't abandon the flesh. We do not therefore go off on a hillside and function in a monastery or a cloister to get away from involvement with life. We don't do that. We stay in there and we still maintain a flesh entity, a flesh person or being. And that flesh being must be ministered to. I've just been working on this matter of the feeding of the 5,000. It's a singular thing to realize that Jesus, in that incident of the feeding of the 5,000, only fed them and let them go. Jesus was accumulating a considerable crowd that was following him. And at one point, he wanted to get away with his disciples, having heard of the death of John the Baptist and being distressed over that, he went away to a quiet place. But the crowd sought him out and followed him. And whereas he might have been of the intention to withdraw and not let them find him, he didn't. But when they came to him, then the first thing that occurred to him was that these people would be hungry. And it says, in fact, in some accounts that they were fainting. It was a long trek up there to the Sea of Galilee, up on this hillside. They had walked a long ways and they were tired. Well, when that occurred to Jesus, he then made provision to feed them. What many people don't realize is that that's all he did. He fed them and then departed from them. He did not assume that every occasion ought to be an evangelistic opportunity. He did not take a contemptuous attitude toward the flesh. I have to go into that because I'm trying to say to you this morning, I'm trying to keep a balance here. The fact that I say to you that the flesh is subject to all kinds of faults and failures and destructions does not mean, therefore, that we ought to ignore the flesh. I'm saying that Jesus did not do that. And he did not assume that spiritual growth depended upon a constant barrage of sermons and meditations. So he did not take every opportunity that he was with people to evangelize. You remember at the wedding feast in Cana of Galilee, what did he do there? He made wine for the crowd. He didn't get off in a corner to entertain those who would come and philosophize with him. There were occasions when Jesus ministered and occasions when he didn't. There are times when he shunned the larger crowds and slipped off to minister to one or two people. The flesh is with us and will be with us as long as we're on the earth, the natural man. We must minister to it, but we must also recognize that it's a tricky old fellow, and we must keep a vigil over the flesh. And we must ask ourselves whether something that we are doing is purely a matter of the flesh or if it's something the Spirit wants of us. Now, that would not mean you have to ask him whether to eat or not. But it might mean whether you should ask him whether you ought to be part of a given social party or not. It is necessary to keep a continual vigil as far as the flesh is concerned. And the essence of that is in the second chapter of Isaiah 55. Wherefore do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Dieting is one of the great issues of the American public, and well it should be, because the American public, as much as any nation on earth, is starving to death while they're getting fat because of the kinds of foods that we eat. But a lot of it is training, upbringing. Children that are raised on junk food will feel that junk foods are an absolute necessity to their taste. You know, they feel that they always have to have things that have plenty of sugar in them, and we coat the cereals and everything else because coated with sugar, you see. And it is one of the most destructive forces in the American diet is sugar. But people consume it by the hundreds of pounds per individual. What I'm saying is we learn to like these things. We get a habit for them. The taste gets a habit, and then we think we can't get along without it. The things of the flesh, Satan loves to sugarcoat them, so we think we can't get along without them. But life has to be more exciting. If it isn't exciting all the time, then we feel like we're being deprived. If we haven't got places to go and things to do. Satan has a way to sugarcoat those things. You find, I think, invariably, you people who are here today especially, find that when you've had some fellowship in the Spirit, it's been a very rewarding thing to you. You enjoy it. When you've been together in the flesh, invariably there are things that happen that cloud it. I can bring you together in a word, under the word here and in fellowship, and I know that you're going to leave here without anything particularly clouding it, especially if I have certain sensitivities in the Spirit to keep a vigil over it, because it is very important if that is going to be true, that you're going to leave here feeling good, then there has to be a vigil that what we do is not in the flesh. That's why I'm so strict about things here, that I don't want the flesh to come in and cloud a very nice experience in the Spirit, you see. So you usually, I think, you go from here feeling that it was a good thing to be here. Or you wouldn't be back if that weren't true. But how many times have you been on just an outing, a thing in the flesh that had some wrinkle in it that cut into the enjoyment of it? I'm not saying, therefore, don't go to things of the flesh. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying realize that whatever's of the Spirit is an uplifting, edifying, building experience. All that we do in the flesh, we spend energy and effort and money and everything for that, and often we come away dissatisfied. We come away with something having scarred it or distorted it. The only thing that will really satisfy you is that which the Spirit appends. I worded it carefully because I say you can go to a lot of things where you're meeting together to eat together and to enjoy things together. You can go to a lot of things if the Spirit has given you that direction to go. And it'll be satisfying. You can go off on a day's outing in the mountains or a weekend or something. If the Lord is with you in it, if you've asked Him and you've gotten His guidance about those things, and you go in the Spirit, you can have a tremendous time together. And the Lord will bless it. And it's enjoyment of nature, the things God has made. And there are a lot of things that you can do as Christians that give you enrichment and so forth. But if they're blessed by the Spirit, they'll be all right. If they're not, it's a potentially disorienting world that is around you, a potentially not disorienting, a potentially destructive world that you're living in. I'm preparing you to find your satisfaction in Christ so that if everything else is wiped out, it doesn't matter. All you really have to bank on is Christ. In a moment of time, like that, in one moment of time, everything can be wiped out. Your health can be wiped out. Your possessions can be wiped out. You have nothing. So cultivate satisfaction in Christ, fellowship with the believers in the name of Christ, and be sensitive or watchful about the things of the flesh, because they will rob you of vitality in the Spirit. Wherefore do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Foods that God has given to us, properly prepared, can be a far greater taste treat than Twinkies or Blinkies or Dinkies. There's a commercial on television that shows a gentleman eating some grapes, and he finds it's rather a surprising new treat, grapes. He doesn't know who invented them, but they're pretty good, and they have a pretty clever name for them, you know. That's a kind of a satire on the American public. We have been duped by the manufacturers into buying tons and tons of their stuff that has been made in the chemical factory, and conned us into thinking that that is far tastier than the original things that God has made for us. There's a good parallel between that which satisfies the body and that which satisfies the spirit. Jesus satisfied the bodies of the physical needs of the people by the Sea of Galilee in that miracle of the loaves, and everybody went away satisfied. It says when they had all been satisfied, is the Greek word there, when they'd all eaten their fill, there were baskets left over, 12 of them, one for each disciple. When everybody had received their absolute fill, because he said as much as they wanted. He said they ate the bread and then the fish, as much as they wanted. And when it was over, there were 12 baskets to take up of the fragments, which indicated that no matter how much they had eaten of their full, that God's provision was beyond the filling point. It was full to overflowing. My cup runneth over. The 12 baskets of the feeding of the 5,000 would be the cup running over. When you let the Spirit of Christ direct your life, the satisfaction is there to the running over point. If you try to satisfy yourselves in the flesh, you'll only come to distress and grief, dissatisfaction. Let's pray.